Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 28 of the True Crime All the Time podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what is happening today?
Man, I'm just excited to be here for another episode of True Crime All the Time.
I feel the excitement. It's radiating.
It is. Maybe it's because it's middle of the week recording.
Yeah, we are. We're recording on a Wednesday, which is a little different for us, but trying to get ahead a little bit. All right, so let's start out with some Patreon shout-outs. We've got Jessica Poole, Carol, Kristen McConnell, Nada, and we've got Joe DeVee for a second time because she upgraded to our highest Patreon package, so I had to give her another shout-out.
One of my faves.
And then we have Amber Stoll. So, as always, thank you so much for supporting us, all the new people, and everyone that continues to support us. A lot of folks have been with us from the very beginning, and it means the world to us.
We got some great supporters.
Yeah, we really do, Mike. And not just on Patreon, right? A lot of people supporting us on social media, just getting the word out to their friends. I mean, that's another great way to support us. There are so many different ways. You know, it doesn't have to be financial. You know, rate and review us on iTunes. If you love the show, don't be afraid to go out, give us a 5-star rating, tell your friends about us, you know, help spread the word. Definitely check out our website at truecrimeallthetime.com. You find all of our contact information, not just for True Crime All the Time, but also for the Unsolved podcast. We've got that on there as well. Our Facebook pages, our Twitter handles. We have a new Facebook group called True Crime All the Time.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. You know, it's a closed group for people that just want to talk about the cases or whatever. So, you know, if you're interested in that, search for the group and, you know, there's some admins that'll let you in. And make sure you check out True Crime All the Time Unsolved. When you're done listening to this episode, make sure you jump over there and try that one out. All right, Gibbs, let's get into the meat of this episode. It's going to be a good one. We're talking about Arthur Shawcross. Arthur Shawcross, American serial killer, has a nickname, has to, right? We always talk about that.
Right.
You have to have at least one. Sometimes you get multiple. But Shawcross is also known as the Genesee River Killer. And the other thing I should have said, his middle name is John, right? Because when you're a serial killer, you have to say all three names.
Absolutely.
Arthur John Shawcross. For some reason, we don't use that hardly in any other field, except for when we're talking about serial killers.
Yeah. We like to just open that up and just use that full name.
You just have to, and I don't know why.
Yeah, he's also known as the Monster of the Rivers and also the Rochester Strangler.
So he gets three nicknames at least.
Yeah, that's how bad he is. Full name and three nicknames. Yeah.
All right, so like we always do, Gibbs, let's talk about early life. And there is a lot to digest here with Arthur Shawcross. He's born June 6th, 1945. And he was born at a U.S. Naval hospital in Maine. And he was a very small premature baby. He was actually 2 months premature. And his father, who's also named Arthur Shawcross, he was a corporal in the Army. So Arthur Shawcross Jr., so from now on, I'm just going to, just when I say Arthur, that's going to be the person we're talking about. It always gets confusing when there's junior and senior.
Yeah.
But Arthur's mom, Bessie, she takes little tiny Arthur to her sister-in-law's in Watertown, New York. And basically, they stay there until the dad, Arthur Sr., completes his military service. It's very hard for me, Gibbs, to think of this Arthur Shawcross as this little preemie baby.
Because you know the whole story.
Because I know the whole story, right?
Right.
Little helpless baby versus all of the footage that you and I have been researching and the monster that we know that this guy is, I can't reconcile those two things in my head.
Yeah, can't either.
It's very hard. I mean, you know everybody's a baby.
Right. Yeah, I know. I mean, you just kind of want to, you want to feel for it, but you can't.
No, he's a monster baby.
Yeah.
Now, Gibbs, it would be found out later that Arthur was born with the XYY chromosome. And I had no idea what this was.
I was going to ask you, what does that mean?
Well, I had to look it up because I thought, okay, this is interesting. Let's explore this. And so I started to do some research on it. And the more I looked into it, the more fascinating it got. Now, you'll also see this referred to as Jacob's syndrome, or what they call like super male syndrome.
Super male.
Yeah, super male. Although that one's kind of fallen out of favor, I think, from the research that I did. And I'll kind of talk about it a little bit. So what it is that males normally have 46 chromosomes in each of their cells. The XYY syndrome results when a male has an extra Y, which causes them to have 47 chromosomes. So basically get an extra chromosome. It occurs in about 1 in every 1,000 male births. So it's not super rare. There's a lot of people out there that have this. And people with this lead very normal lives. For the, you know, usually no problem. Now, there are some symptoms, though, that can manifest, such as delayed speech, delayed motor skills, learning disabilities, and I think most importantly for what we're talking about, emotional and behavioral issues.
What? Why are you pointing at me?
No, I'm not. I'm gesturing with my hands. We should have you tested, though, but beside the point. But those last two in particular, I mean, those are the ones to keep in mind as we go through this early life of Arthur Shawcross.
Sure.
Because, yeah, and that's why I thought it was so interesting. Now, getting back to the super male syndrome, that it you will see it referred to that, but I think that's an older term. And it really came out because I think some of the older research, they thought that this having this extra chromosome made somebody much more likely to be predisposed to violence. So I think that's why they were calling, you know, super male, macho,
right,
whatever you want to call it.
More of an aggressive male.
Yeah, but that's kind of fallen out of favor. And because a lot of the more recent research appears to disprove all of that. And it's really starting to indicate that males that have this XYY syndrome are no more likely to commit violent crimes than males that just have the XY. Like we said, there are some symptoms. There are some things that can manifest itself from having this extra chromosome. All right, so back to Arthur. You know, we talked about his mom and dad, Arthur Sr. and Betty, or Bessie. I think she went by both. So he was the first of four. He had two sisters, Donna and Jeannie, and he had a brother named James. The family moved to Watertown, New York, just shortly after Arthur was born. And the family built this small little house in a rural area. It was about 6 miles outside of Watertown near Brownville. Now, one thing that I thought was very interesting is that a bunch of other families started building right around them, and they were all related. So at one point, they started to call this little area where they had settled Shawcross Corner, because basically it was all
Shawcrosses?
All Shawcrosses. So for the most part, in this Shawcross Corner, everything was happy, right? Everybody was growing up. There was a bunch of kids. Everybody was leading just a normal, happy life. The problem was Arthur, from a very early age, he started to show signs of abnormal behavior. Now, Arthur would claim that his adolescence was very turbulent, very violent. He would talk about his difficult relationship that he had with both of his parents, but in particular, his mother. You know, he said that she was very domineering, and he blamed a lot of his later troubles on his mother.
My mother gave me oral sex. She performed oral sex on me for several years. Then when I was 14 years old, I did intercourse, and I ran away. I put a note on my pillow in my bedroom. I'm going to Syracuse, and I turned around and went to Canada. I just didn't want to go home.
Very young, he ran away from home. He used to hide under the teacher's desk. He was an extremely bizarre and troubled child very, very early on. So that there's a consistency to this history of abuse.
All right, Gib. So at age 5, Arthur misses 33 days of kindergarten. Seems a little excessive.
A little. Kindergarten?
I mean,
33 days?
All you got to do is go and listen to people read books and drink milk and take a nap.
I mean, back then you took a lot of naps, sung a song, and I don't even know if you even cut and paste then.
I don't know. Half day, you're home. So to miss 33 days.
That's quite a bit.
There's something there. He was talking baby talk. And again, at 5 years old, that's not that strange. The only reason I point it out is because we're going to be talking about it for quite a number of years to come.
Oh.
So don't think at 5 that that's super, a little strange, I guess, at 5, but not out of the ordinary too much. You know, you get to 15, 16, it's going to become a little strange.
It's a little different.
And the same thing with being a chronic bedwetter, right? Again, at age 5, there's a lot of people that wet the bed.
Yeah.
Not as many at age 16. So I'm just kind of setting the scene.
What about adult life? Is it an issue?
Well, you know, from like 5's not a big deal. 95, okay, yeah. That's pretty normal.
Yeah, in between.
A lot of the space in between,
yeah,
not as normal. But it is going to be a constant theme. He would say later on, because again, like a lot of cases we talk about, much of the information that we get comes from Arthur himself in later interviews. And you have to try to parse out how much of it is real and how much of it is BS.
Right, yeah.
Because there's a lot of it is BS. You know that not everything the guy's saying is true. But we have to talk about it because he did say
it. Because he says it, right.
Yeah. And what he would blame a lot of this on, again, we talked about his mother, but specifically the fact that he would always say that his mother didn't like him as much as his siblings and didn't pay as much attention to him as she did his brothers and sisters. This was a major problem for him, mostly because he craved attention. That's the kind of person he was. He was an attention seeker. He needed it.
This is when he was around 6 years old.
This is 5'6".
So for me, it's weird because I couldn't tell you much about my early childhood. I don't really have a lot of recall. I start recalling things around sixth grade. Prior to that, I don't have much recall.
So here's my theory. You tell me what you think. Is it because you had a normal, healthy, good childhood and there was nothing that stood out, whereas some of these individuals, if you believe what they're saying, there were things that happened that were so traumatic that they remembered them every day of their lives or became such a big part of their life? That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, that might be it. Yeah.
So I'm throwing it out there because I'm the same way as you. I had a great childhood, but I couldn't tell you what I was doing at 5 years old to save my life.
No.
I know at one point I was eating paper towels. Don't ask me why.
Yeah.
Like full paper towels.
I didn't do that, but I can understand why you would.
I can actually remember stealing paper towels, going outside, eating them, but I can remember it.
Well, I'm sure your mom remembered it because she probably had to be there for you when
when things started coming out.
Absolutely. Good thing she's a nurse.
That is true. All right, so age six. And like I said, we got a lot of his early life. A lot of it from him, but some of it from other places. But I think it's important because it sets the stage. He starts running away from home. And he would do this a lot. But at age six, it's pretty early.
Yeah, what is that? Kindergarten, first grade?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Kindergarten, first grade, I guess it would
be. I mean, it's not like the kids, you know, I'm upset. I'm going to. Because you turn the TV, I'm going to walk out and I'm going to run away.
Well, it's not like that. You know, it used to be that you would go pack a travel bag with your stuffed animal and a toothbrush and you would say, I'm going to run away.
Right.
But nobody ever did.
No.
But he did.
He actually did.
And he would do it over and over. But like other things, he blamed it on abuse that he suffered at home. We have to talk about this because his family denies all of this. And they basically said that, you know, he was an attention seeker and that some of these things that he did. So he did run away from home, let's say, but it was because he wanted attention. It wasn't because he was being abused. Now, at age seven, he started having conversations with imaginary friends. Not too strange. I think a lot of kids, younger kids, have that going on. To what extent, you know, I'm not saying like Sixth Sense or, you know, anything like that, but, you know, you got an imaginary friend to keep you company. But there's no doubt, Gibbs, that Arthur Shawcross was a strange boy from a very young age. And this came from a lot of different sources. You know, it was said that he was a hypochondriac. He was always pretending to have some type of illness in order to get attention. Now, one of the things that Arthur would say later in life was that he became obsessed with sex at a very early age, like abnormally early.
I think we've heard this before. The Carr brothers. The oldest Carr brother was having sex by the time he was in first or second grade, right?
You're right. Very early.
Yeah.
So Arthur starts conducting what they said was various sexual experiments. But it became more than just like a normal kid's curiosity, right? He claimed later in life that at age seven, he was masturbating daily and had already had oral sex with both male and female friends. Age seven.
Wow. And you had to wait till high school.
I'm glad you gave me that credit. But I mean, that's something else, man. Age seven.
Yeah, that's disturbing.
So let's go to age eight. And he's having all kinds of other behavioral problems. You know, one of the things that really jumped out to me was he was bullied in school. He was called a loner. A lot of people referred to him as weird, right? Later on, they would look back and say, well, Arthur was weird. So he got picked on a lot. His classmates even called him Audie, as in like he's odd. They called him Audie. That was his nickname. Hey folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. True Crime All the Time is sponsored by BetterHelp. I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT. So he didn't mix with other kids well. He didn't communicate with other kids well. And it was said that most times he would just sit alone in an empty classroom while all the other kids were outside at recess. But the very strange thing about this, Gibbs, is his grades were actually pretty good. You know, well above average. Even though everybody said he was troubled.
I thought I read somewhere that his IQ was something like 83.
You know, like we said, he was constantly running away. And he even carried an iron bar on the school bus to threaten other children with. And so this was a theme in his life. He got bullied a lot, but he also chose to bully younger, weaker kids. That was his thing because he was getting bullied. He took that frustration out on other kids that he could bully himself.
Yeah. So he picked out the weak ones and picked on them to make himself feel more powerful.
Correct. Now, by the time he got into third grade, his behavior started going downhill pretty quickly, and his grades went down fast as well. And this was at the first time that he started to take some psychological testing. And what it did was indicate that his behavior was mostly due to these feelings he had of being inadequate and feeling rejected, and this real bad hostility that he had towards his parents, in particular his mother. Even through all this, right, his grades were really poor at this point. He's going through these psychological tests. He's still promoted to the fourth grade. Now, he has to stay there a couple years, but, you know, we'll talk about that. And that's going to happen a number of times. He's still talking baby talk. It's in third grade, right, as he's getting promoted to fourth grade. This is when he has his first head injury, Gibbs. And I say first because there's going to be a number of them. He gets hit in the head with a stone. Now, on the surface, that doesn't sound too bad. I mean, I think we've all had rocks thrown at us and things like that. So, but this must have been some kind of stone because it results in a pretty serious injury. You know, he's hospitalized. He needs a lot of stitches, but what it causes is numbness in different parts of his body, which would go on for many, many years. So it was a pretty serious blow.
Yes, that's a severe head injury.
And the knot that resulted, it never went away.
Wow.
It never went away. It was always there for the rest of his life. So that tells me it was either a great big stone or
a hell of hitting a throw. Just,
right. Somebody with a rocket arm. I don't know.
Cy Young.
Yeah. You want to pick somebody from this century or?
Well, going back to when he was. I don't even know how. I'm not a baseball guy.
I know you are. That's why I was giving you shit about it.
This white spot right here in the frontal white matter is the part that I was talking about. That's abnormal. Multiple sclerosis could look like that, but there's no history of anything like that. There is a history of head trauma to that part of the brain. That's what the cause of it is, in all likelihood. When I touched his face and his arm simultaneously, he only felt it on his face. That was a positive face hand test. In other words, he's ignored the more distal of two sensory stimuli. He was not concentrating on the stimuli. His memory's fine. It's his concentration that's affected, and that's the pattern that you see in frontal deficits. There seems to be a cyst in the right temporal. Shawcross had several neurologic abnormalities that were quite significant. The most important of them was that he had a right Babinski reflex. That means when I stroked the bottom of his right foot, the big toe went up. Just a slight movement, a few millimeters. That indicates that there is disease of a major tract in the brain on the opposite side. There's a deficit. There could be no controversy over that. Could be no controversy over that. The only issue is, what's the relationship between the brain damage, demonstrable brain damage, and the behavior? And people who think that there is no relationship between them would say that there are other people who have similar brain damage who don't aren't murderers. I agree with that wholeheartedly. But you take the background of abuse that Arthur Shawcross has had and combine it with this brain damage, and that's the reason that he is Arthur Shawcross.
So I wanted to play this clip here because it talks about the abuse. It talks about some brain damage, repeated head injuries, even though we haven't talked about all the head injuries yet. Now, something very important happened when Arthur was 9 years old. And his mother finds out that Arthur Sr., the dad, has this other wife and son in Australia. And it was from this time forward that all of the relatives would say she became a different person. She started, you know, going into these jealous rages, and she was constantly fighting with Arthur Sr. And he kind of changed as well. He just became quiet and kind of withdrew, and she just started almost like dominating him. We talk about it, Gibbs. How much did Arthur Shawcross Jr. pick up on this? And we know from most of our episodes that these kids are picking up way more than the parents think they
Absolutely.
Are. And they're learning a lot of this behavior. And it was at this point where Arthur ran away again. He just didn't run away. He made it all the way to the Canadian border. So again, this is not a kid putting Snuggles and their favorite book in a backpack and saying, making it halfway down the street and then turning around.
This is 9 years old.
Yeah. 9 year old. Now he's in New York, so it's not, but still.
Still, you gotta, I mean, it's a trek. I mean, it's just not going around the corner.
He did this time and time again. He would run off. You know, we said he was held back. He had to repeat the fourth grade. He cried a lot. He was still talking or speaking in this baby talk. The kids were constantly bullying him. He was getting into a lot of fights. But like we talked about, he's still bullying younger kids. Still wetting the bed, having nightmares. I mean, this just goes on for a long time. But as these years would kind of unwind, the one thing that everybody knew was that Arthur Shawcross was becoming increasingly violent, picking on kids. He would beat up a lot of the neighborhood children. Now, he got his ass kicked too, but he was becoming well known for this explosive temper. 10 years old, he starts breaking into houses. He starts stealing from businesses, and he starts lighting fires. So now we're getting into some of the things that you and I like to talk about. So you've got arson, you've got bedwetting, you've got head trauma.
Yeah, and an angry mom.
And those are three big ones that we see a lot of in serial killers.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just line it up right there.
And he does torture animals, and we haven't even talked about that yet.
What are you going to tell me next? He joined the military?
Yes, he did. But we'll get to that.
Wow.
which I hate because it always sounds like we're bagging on the military.
And we're not.
And that's the furthest thing from
nothing but love there, man.
So at one point, he's still 10 years old. He falls into a river at a family picnic. He's complaining of soreness and headaches. And they actually give him a brain scan. And the tests come back, nothing. They don't see anything. Now, his family would say later on that this was just yet another one of Arthur's attempts to gain attention, right? He always wanted to go to the hospital. He was always complaining about this or that, or he just wanted somebody to pay attention to him because, real or not, he didn't think that they did. So one of the crazy stories happens at age 11. And Gibbs, I know this is your favorite. And this is where Arthur would say later on that his mom jams a broomstick up his keister.
Ouch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And at the same time, she threatened him with the butcher's knife.
I think I would take the butcher knife.
Instead of the broomstick up your...
Well, not the knife up there. Just go ahead and do it, you know, take care of me, man. A broomstick up your keister?
Yeah. And wow. And normally I wouldn't laugh about this because it would be child abuse. But the reason that I think I can, or we can laugh about and joke about this, is because I don't think it's true.
You think this is something he fabricated?
Yeah. I think he told a lot of stories later on after, you know, he was caught and incarcerated, and that's probably going to be a part two.
See, so I agree with you. You know, I think he is like making it, but part of me was saying, I was thinking, if he wasn't making this up, if it really did happen, then it kind of makes me go back to like when he always wanted to see the doctor or go to the hospital. There's a lot of kids that are abused and for real, and I think they want to be seen by people like that, hoping that they're discovered the abuse, because they're not going to come out and say they're being abused because they're so afraid. So by going to the hospital, saying things hurt, they're hoping that somehow someone clues in and saves them.
That is a great point. It might be one of the best points you've ever made in the history of the TCAT podcast.
I'm good for like one a year. So there you go.
But no, that's an unbelievable point. Now, the question is, why wouldn't he say, you know, my butt hurts, take a look? And obviously, a doctor would be able to tell that, you know, he'd been violated.
I would think.
But to your point, maybe he doesn't want to do that. He just wants to go and have the doctor find out on his own.
Yeah.
So in a normal child, that I would say that was the case. With Arthur Shawcross, there's just so many things that he said, it's really hard to believe. Now, of course, the mom comes out. She denies this whole story. And even the psychologist, although they couldn't tell for sure that he was lying, I think they were kind of leaning towards the fact that he was not telling the entire truth. Either way, whether some of this stuff is real or whether it's just a fantasy in Arthur's mind, this plays a part, because later on we're going to see the pursuit of sexual gratification becomes this major role in his life.
So then that has, you know, another avenue, because, you know, we know a few years earlier he's already attempted oral sex with both female and male. You know, at what, age 7 or something crazy like that. Masturbating multiple times throughout the day, every week. Maybe he's the one that tried the broomstick up the keister. And he's just recalling that, but he's putting the spin on it that his mom did it. You know, because these are tales he's telling way down the road.
Oh, way down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, who knows, right?
Yeah. But what we do know is that he ultimately starts to combine the pain, the physical pain, with the sexual gratification. So either this really happened, or like you said, it was all in his head, or he did it himself. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it does eventually, all of this leads to him becoming one of the most brutal serial killers around. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, this is, up to this point, this is minor what we're talking about.
Oh, we're just setting the stage.
Yeah.
There, no doubt about that.
And this is all serious. And you know, we've joked a little bit here and there in the last half hour. But that's the takeaway from it. It's pretty disturbing, and it's gonna get really disturbing.
Oh, well, there won't be much joking when we get to that part at all. And like I said, the reason why I think we can joke about this part is because I don't believe him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's the only reason. If I thought this was a kid that was really being abused,
oh, nothing funny about it at all.
I would never joke about it.
Right.
So he just goes on becoming, you know, more antisocial. He keeps withdrawing from everybody, and he gets held back again in the eighth grade. And at this point, he's 3 years older than his classmates, but he didn't seem to care at all. You know, he was playing the role of the outcast, and it didn't seem to bother him. At least that's, you know, what everybody seemed to remember about him. Eighth grade. He's 3 years older than everybody. He's still having nightmares. He's still wetting the bed. And he's still speaking in this baby talk.
And he wonders why he's getting his ass kicked.
Yeah, he's a teenager at this point. Maybe a young 12, 13 years old.
I certainly don't believe that people should bully. You're not helping your case talking like a Teletubby.
No, there's
walking
no
around
way.
School.
And just, you know, acting strange on purpose and all of these things. Like you said, there should be no bullying. But the other thing, Gibbs, we have to talk about this time versus today. There was a lot of bullying going on back then.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And there wasn't all the anti-bullying campaigns and...
Yeah, the awareness was not there.
All the awareness that we have today. So as we get into his mid-teens, so let's say like 14 years old, Gibbs, still wetting the bed, completely withdrawn... It was said that he would spend hours just walking in the woods, talking to himself, and that people saw him. They remembered seeing him just stopping and then yelling at like an inanimate object, saying that his dad invented the question mark.
Really?
No, I added that.
Well,
that's from Austin Powers.
Oh.
You know, these are the kind of strange things he's doing, very odd behavior.
Did he have a frog demon?
I think he had something.
Yeah.
Because, and like we heard in the clip, he had some mental disability. You know, whether it all stemmed from the repeated blows to the head, whether some of it stemmed from the extra chromosome, because that was a possible, you know, symptom of that. Gibbs, we've got to talk about this, and it's out of timeline, but I saved it and I moved it down on purpose. Shawcross would say that age 9, his aunt got him to perform oral sex on her. And this was obviously a big deal to him. It stuck in his mind. At age 14, he would claim that he was having oral sex with his sister, Jeannie, regularly. Also with his cousin, he would claim that he had another relationship with this young girl who lived in the same area. And at one point was caught by her brother while he was performing oral sex on this girl. What's the common denominator in all of these things?
It's a lot of oral sex there.
And this is going to be a huge thing for him. Now, what happens, according to Shawcross, is that this girl's brother threatened to tell their parents unless Arthur Shawcross performed oral sex on him as well. So again, did this happen? I don't know. You have to go by the words of Arthur.
Yeah, seems a bit extreme.
According to him, all of this really kicked his sex drive up and he became insatiable. And he continued to have oral sex whenever he got the opportunity. And the reason why I'm harping on this oral sex, and I've never said oral sex so many times over and over in my entire life, But the reason why I'm saying it is because never once does Arthur Shawcross talk about having actual sexual intercourse, penetration, during any of this time period. And the thought was, is that he was not able to get or keep an erection from an early age. That's what some of the psychologists would say. And again, we talked about him associating violence with sex. You know, that is something that would kick off much of what would happen later on down the road. And at age 14, his story is that he's walking home from school and he's picked up by a man in a convertible, and the man held him by the throat while the man performed oral sex on Arthur. Now, Arthur couldn't have an orgasm, and this made the man furious. Again, this is all a story by Arthur Shawcross. And so the man raped him in the car and eventually dropped him off near his house. It was from that point that Shawcross claims he could never have an orgasm without some infliction of pain.
So he finally is going to associate pain with sex, and that's just how it's going to be for him.
Yeah, I think, like I said, it may have started with the broomstick, if that actually occurred.
Mm-hmm.
He says it did. But this is where I think it really solidified itself, because never again could he have an orgasm without inflicting pain on himself or having somebody inflict it on him. Now, later on, he would actually brag to some of these psychologists, right? Because they studied him, you know, after he was caught. And we'll get to all that in part two. But he would brag to psychologists that he had sex with sheep, cows, a horse, and that he had even killed a chicken while he was in the process of trying to have sex with it. That's weird, Gibbs.
Just thinking about it makes me want to vomit, man.
I know, weird, and that's weird.
That is beyond weird and bizarre.
All right, so let's jump forward to age 16. This son of a bitch gets hit in the head again. This time with a discus. He spends 4 days in the hospital. Now, this won't be the last time that he takes something to the dome. He's got a number of head injuries, and you just have to wonder what all these head injuries, did they lead to some of the mental instability that they know he had? Or did he have it and just happen to get hit in the head as well a bunch of times?
Yeah, interesting.
Again, we talked about this a little bit, but his parents and even his brothers and sisters would come out and say that they all had a very normal childhood, that everything that Arthur Shawcross says later on in life was BS.
And I believe that's true. But if it wasn't true, you sure wouldn't be coming out and saying, oh, yeah, my brother went down on me many times.
Yeah, you're right.
You know,
you're right. I'm with you. I believe it's true, but there's no way somebody would admit to that. You're absolutely right.
Right.
But the reason why I believe it is because I think Shawcross, he changed his story so many times over the years that it's almost hard. You know, it almost becomes unbelievable.
You know, my wife and I, we both use Rakuten when we shop online to help save money. My wife uses it more than I do because, well, let's face it, she shops more than I do. Rakuten is the most rewarding way to shop and save because members earn cash back on everything that they buy. Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while doing it? It really is a no-brainer. I use it for all my
techie stuff at stores like Best Buy. My wife uses it at stores like Sephora and Macy's. Best of all, membership is free and it's easy to sign up. It's very easy to use. Cashback rates change daily. So start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cashback really adds up.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact. Helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
We know throughout school, he was truant all the time. He didn't have a very high IQ.
I researched it somewhere around the 80s.
Yeah, something about the 80s. He was bullying. He had a tendency for violence. He ends up dropping out of school after failing to pass the ninth grade. Now, he should have already graduated. I think all of his contemporaries probably had graduated, right? He was at least 3 years behind everybody. He's 17 years old and has not passed the ninth grade. So he starts burglarizing homes. He's stealing anything he can get his hands on. And as we see a lot of times, Gibbs, he starts peeping.
Oh, yeah.
Into houses. That's something we see a lot with these guys.
Right.
And the next few years of his life is a lot of violence. And he actually, you know, serves some time for petty stuff. In 1963, Arthur's 18 years old. And he's arrested for breaking into a Sears. But he gets probation. Because he didn't actually take anything out of the store. I think he just broke through the window. But either they caught him before he could take anything or he just happened not to take anything. The very next year, he meets and marries his first wife, Sarah. And Arthur and Sarah would have a son, Michael, in October of 65. But he gets in trouble again in 65 for unlawful entry. This proved to be it for Sarah. She just couldn't take it. And she files for divorce soon after this, you know, he gets this other charge. Now, Sarah would go on to remarry. And her new husband would adopt the son, Michael. And it was said that Arthur never saw his son again. So you got to figure, his son was only a year or two old.
Yeah, that'd be about right.
And he never saw him again, ever.
Probably a lucky kid at this point.
No, probably, because if he'd have grown up in that, he would have maybe not turned out very well. Hopefully he did turn out well. Now, at the age of 20, Shawcross was arrested for punching a 13-year-old kid for throwing a snowball at him, which seems appropriate. Appropriate response for that. Now, he got 6 months probation, and again, he would be interviewed by psychologists in the jail, and they labeled him as emotionally unstable. So by the time he's 20, Gibbs, let's kind of break this down. Number of head injuries. He's had quite a few psychological evaluations.
Right.
I mean, I'm 43 years old. I've never had one. And by the time he's 20, he's had at least three or four.
Yeah, that's quite a bit. One more than me.
By the time you were 20? It's way higher now, right?
Much higher. But you said between now and 20, so I wasn't going to go to the next level.
So the next couple of years for Arthur are just kind of directionless. You know, he moves from job to job. He's involved in petty theft. Sometimes he's caught. Most times he's not. As you and I always say, none of these people get in trouble.
They never do.
It's always slap on the wrist type stuff. Now, he hasn't done anything horrible. I mean, I guess punching a 13-year-old kid's not very good. But he hasn't committed like any super serious crimes where he would need to serve serious time.
Yeah, that we're aware of.
But that's coming. But there's a turning point in his life. And it comes in 1968 because Arthur is drafted and goes to Vietnam. So right before he gets deployed to Vietnam, Arthur meets a woman named Linda Neary. They end up getting married after a very brief time dating. And it was said that they got married because they both had a thought that Arthur would probably be killed. So they figured they should just get married. Now, when Arthur gets to Vietnam, he's a supply clerk. He has duties of distributing ammunition. And to do that, he has to travel by helicopter to some of the units in the field. This is where he starts to get into some fantasies because he was seeing psychiatrists while he was in Vietnam, and he starts telling them about going out on these fire missions with, you know, these fighting units. But basically he's just riding in a helicopter, dropping off ammunition and then coming back.
Right. So he's
and sitting behind a desk. So he would tell these psychiatrists initially that he was shocked by all this violence, but that he soon found that he was craving the danger of going into the jungle alone, looking for the enemy. And eventually he calls himself a predator, like a one-man wrecking crew predator.
Arnold.
This guy is a flipping supply clerk.
Yeah.
They probably only, he's probably got one bullet in his gun, like Barney Fife.
Right. Yeah.
The stories that he would tell from Vietnam about him going on these missions.
No doubt about it. There were some crazy things that happened over there. A lot of crazy stories. But do you believe his? That's the thing. I mean, you know, you have the tunnel rats. Crazy things that those folks had to do, man.
I'm sure some of what he's saying or is about to say happened.
It just wasn't him.
I just don't know if it was him or not.
Yeah. He took somebody else's story.
If he was a quote unquote grunt out on the front lines,
right,
maybe I would believe it. But the Army even disputes anything he says because, like they said, he's a supply clerk.
Right.
You know, he wasn't platoon.
Yeah.
He wasn't those guys trudging through the...
These are just stories he either heard or, like you said, he fabricated.
So here's one. So he's on one of these predator missions by himself. Now, at what point would anybody be wanting to go by themselves through the jungles of Vietnam? But he claims that he encounters these two Vietnamese women that were hiding guns in like a hollowed out tree. And he shoots one of the women immediately and he ties the other one to a tree. And the woman that he shot was still breathing. So he cuts her head off and he mounts it on a post for the enemy to find. I'm going to do a little warning here. If anybody's eating like a pulled pork sandwich or anything along those lines, you might want to put that down. Or just do a quick pause and come back after you've digested.
Yeah.
Because what he claims is that he cuts off a section of her thigh. This is the woman that he shot. He roasts it over a fire and he eats it. Now, remember, this other lady is tied to a tree watching him. So then he says he has oral sex with this woman tied to the tree. Again, oral sex. Now, he does claim that he raped her and then shot her in the head and butchered her body. But the stories don't stop there.
No.
Because somehow the supply clerk becomes an expert sniper. He said that he took a rubber nipple from a baby's bottle and he fashioned that into a silencer, which allowed him to shoot the enemy from far away without giving away his position. I mean, a bullet would rip the shit out of that rubber nipple. I don't see it that being a silencer in any any form or fashion.
I was say, it's not like he's walking around with a bag full of baby nipples. So, I mean...
Well, that's a good question. Where's he getting all these baby bottle nipples? Yeah. Is he having them shipped over?
In the middle of the jungle, Vietnam jungle. If it did work, it'd only be good for one time, right? So, like I said, he'd have to have 30 of them on him. But, this doesn't make any sense.
Well, let's hear Arthur Shaw Cross himself.
A lot of things happened in Vietnam. Yeah, I went to Vietnam as a weapons specialist. And I had my own bunker and just outside of Con Tum, Vietnam, Central Highlands. And I see a woman in her 30s coming down this hill carrying two AKs on this side and two AKs on this side, barrel down. So I reach over my shoulder like this, right behind my neck, and I pull out a brand new machete. When she backed out, I come up behind her and took her head right there. It took a couple of hits, but the head came off. She body dropped to the ground. She just bled out. I split the body in half. Opened up a pouch, and I had some C4, plastic explosives. Lit a cigarette, just touched it, and it started lit up like a miniature sun. And I just laid the flesh up on top of that stick, right? And I bit into the flesh itself. Just staring at her eyes, and she urinated and defecated on herself. And she talked to me in broken English, so she told me everything I wanted to know. I go in, I report her in, saluted the colonel, and he gets up and he says, "You one sick son of a bitch, but I love you. But I can't remember nobody's name in Vietnam, and that messes me up."
Wow.
I have to laugh a little bit because I'm picturing like this guy is Rambo. I mean, Rambo doesn't do some of this crazy stuff.
Yeah, this is bizarre, man.
So Shawcross says that he became an animal in Vietnam. This is where everything ratchets and he has a hard time controlling all of his violent urges that are driving him to rape and kill. And he says it wasn't just like, the enemy that he did this to. He claims to have attacked several Asian prostitutes. In his own words, some of these girls were as young as 11. I don't know why he's telling these stories. They're not making him look good, right? He's not doing it to look like a hero. Is it Gibbs that... he's caught and he just has nothing to lose and he's wants to be interesting.
I think it, I actually think that's probably what it is. I think it's a lot of them keep trophies or whatever. And this is, they like to relive it. This is him reliving it.
Well, but reliving something that probably didn't happen.
Well, now he might've... I think he's trying to make himself more infamous than he really is.
Now, I believe that he may be assaulted and raped some prostitutes while he was over there. That's not a stretch for me.
Right.
Given what we know is coming. But like we talked about, the army, they couldn't corroborate anything. And if you heard Arthur on the tape, what he said he went over there as a combat specialist, I think. But the army comes back and says, the guy was a supply clerk. Arthur says he had 39 confirmed combat kills. The army comes back after an investigation and says he didn't kill anybody from behind his desk. Now, what did happen while he was in the army is that he fell off a 40-foot ladder and landed on his head.
Oh, no.
So this is number three.
Yeah, this is huge.
I mean, this guy cannot stop getting hit in the head, landing on his head. So the whole Vietnam thing, I mean, and really the reason I talk about it is just to, It's interesting. It's gory. But again, I don't know that any of it happened. But he says it did, so.
Must be true if he said it.
We have to talk about it. So Arthur returns home to Watertown, where he grew up, in 1969. Now, we don't know what for sure he experienced in Vietnam, but the one thing that was true is that he didn't come back the same man. He was changed. And everybody said that he changed for the worse. Now, remember, he wasn't great to begin with. He was no bed of roses. But now he's even worse. It was said that he was always agitated. He couldn't relax at all. Always getting upset with people. Now, remember, he had married this woman named Linda right before he deployed. So he comes home. He finds out that his wife had spent every dime that he had sent home for her and that she was also seeing somebody else.
Well, that's just going to piss him off now, won't it?
Yeah, he's not going to be happy about that. But he ends up getting transferred to Fort Sill in Oklahoma because he still has to serve out the remainder of his term. But Linda goes with him. So they didn't separate, even though she was unfaithful and he couldn't have been happy about that.
Right.
It's when they get to Fort Sill that Linda says Arthur begins having these really bad, violent flashbacks and nightmares. And you hear that a lot from guys that were in Vietnam. I had an uncle that served in Vietnam and he had some of those, you know, to the point where he wouldn't talk about it at all.
Right. And that's normally what you find.
The people that really experience the shit, they don't want to talk about
it. That's nothing they want to, they don't want to relive. It's already bad enough. They're trying to suppress it as much as they can.
They're sure not sitting around bragging about what they had to do.
No.
But he ends up beating Linda. This leads her to have him taken to an army psychiatrist. So again, this guy has seen a lot of psychiatrists and this one suggests therapy and wants to put him in a mental hospital. The problem is that Linda was a Christian Scientist.
That's an interesting twist.
Yeah. And that's not something that I know much about and don't hear a lot about of, but she was very leery of doctors and hospitals in general, and she refuses to commit Arthur. She could have, but she refused. So Arthur doesn't get therapy, which he probably should have, and his mental state begins to decline. And in April of 69, his frustration boils over. And he ends up setting fire to a local paper mill. And later that same year, he sets fire to another factory where he was actually employed.
Wow.
So here, the arson kind of coming back into it.
Yep.
He was arrested. He ended up getting convicted for burglary of a gas station, which they must have caught him on too, and three separate counts of arson. He gets sentenced to 5 years in prison. And the first 6 months of that sentence is in Attica. And that's no joke.
No, it's big time.
Now, it's in Attica. And again, this is an Arthur Shawcross story. So you believe it or you don't believe it.
Is this where the chanting comes in?
Attica. No, he probably wishes it was just the chanting if what happens is real. Because he alleges that three black inmates raped him. And he then claims that he got revenge on them by beating and raping each one of them in separate incidents. And because of that, he was transferred to another prison, Auburn Prison, to serve out his sentence. A little bit of Rambo with some Steven Seagal thrown in.
Yeah.
Exacting justice. I wonder how much of this is just fantasy in his head.
I think there's a good chunk of it.
I mean, he may very well have been raped in prison. For him to exact revenge on each one of these people and be able to, how likely is that? Probably not very.
Yeah.
Now, he actually gets out early. He doesn't serve the whole 5 years because in 71, there's a prison riot. And it's sparked by some racial tension. And this is true. Arthur Shawcross actually saves the life of a prison guard who was being beaten during the riot. And because of that, they give him an early release. He returns again to Watertown, where he's lived his whole life, vowing to start a new life. Linda, by this time, has divorced him. Now, the one thing we have to talk about is his time in prison, because it didn't do anything good for him, right? His mental state going in was not good. This stint in prison didn't do anything to help that. If anything, it made it worse. He came out even more agitated and ready to just take on anyone or anything. He was ready to fight. That's basically his mindset.
All the buttons have been pushed.
Yeah.
There's nothing else to push now.
No, I think he's at that state.
He's at that level.
All right, Gibbs. Now we got to get into the spiral of Arthur Shawcross, because this is where it really begins. So he wants to start a new life and he settles back into Watertown, like we said, and he takes a job at the Public Works Department as a handyman. And he actually gets married again for the third time. This guy has no problem getting married, I'll tell you that. His new wife, Penny, was actually friends with one of his sisters. And she had two children from a former relationship. Now, Shawcross would claim that up to this time, he was still having a sexual relationship with his sister. She introduced him to Penny because she had gotten pregnant with her boyfriend, his sister had, and could no longer continue their relationship. I'm trying to think of something to say, man.
I just don't know what. Is it like a letter of recommendation? Hey,
I don't know.
He's really good at, you know,
oral sex.
Give it a try. He's my brother, but yeah, so now he's yours, and I think you'd be happy with it. That's strange. What a strange story.
It is, and again, as we've said, all of his family comes out and has denied every bit of this because obviously they can't be happy being linked to all this craziness.
No,
especially if it didn't happen, which we're thinking it probably didn't.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it didn't. Cause if it did, it's jacked up.
I'm thinking if it happened, all the stuff he said actually did happen with the family, I think there would be more people that would have come out to talk about it.
I think you're right. I think there would be people that could corroborate his story. And I didn't find any of that corroboration.
Right.
So basically you have one man saying something and you have all the rest of the people saying, no, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That's basically what we have.
I mean, we know people like to, no matter how bizarre, twisted, wrong things are, people like to talk about it. So somebody would have said something to their boyfriend or their girlfriend or something, you know, throughout time.
So it's only about 5 months into this new marriage with Penny. She becomes pregnant, but then later has a miscarriage. And it's sometime just right after this, Shawcross claims that the marriage starts to fall apart because Penny's father accuses him of sexually assaulting Penny's younger sister.
I'm guessing the odds are good.
Well, this is one that he actually denies.
Oh, okay.
You know, he seems to take credit for a lot, but he actually denied this one. But as you can imagine, Penny's parents had it out for him from that point on. This is where what we talked about in the beginning comes back around, because one of the parts that's interesting about the fact that Penny became pregnant and the allegation of this sexual assault is that by his own words, Shawcross claims that he was incapable of maintaining an erection or having an orgasm. Now, if you can't do those two things, that makes having a child pretty difficult. But again, that's his words. Yeah. So one thing that we know to be a fact, right? We haven't had a lot of facts, Gibbs. A lot of this is speculation, Arthur's words. One fact that was known was that he spent a lot of time fishing. He spent a lot of time fishing with some of the kids around town. He would often share the same fishing spot with these kids and talk to them. And one of the kids that he fished with was a 10-year-old named Jack Blake. Now, on the morning of May 7th, 1972, Jack goes out to play. And this area was known as the Cloverdale Apartments. This is where Shawcross lived. It ends up that Jack never comes home. And his family is frantic. And his mother actually knocks on Arthur's door later that night and says, you know, have you seen my son? Do you know where he is? Because she knows that this guy apparently had been fishing with her son at various times. He had told her that he hadn't seen him since that morning. But the truth of it is, Shawcross had taken Jack, taken him into the woods, stripped him naked, and he forced him to run through the woods. And I don't know, Gibbs, if this was some kind of game that Shawcross was playing, almost like the most dangerous game.
Yeah, he could have been going back to his Vietnam days.
So he strips him naked, this poor 10-year-old boy. It's almost like the most twisted game of hide and seek or whatever it is, but he finally catches him. And he sexually assaults the boy and eventually strangles him and ends up beating him. And, you know, it was a violent, brutal death. There's no two ways about it. But it gets so much worse because Shawcross would later admit that he removed the boy's heart and genitals and ate them. So again, I know we've been doing a lot to lead up to this point. I can't imagine, because at some point, Gibbs, you know, the family knows this is what happened to their son.
Oh yeah. How devastating is that, man?
And bad enough that their son is killed, but to be violated in such a brutal way, that has to add even something to something that's already horrific. So it makes you wonder, it's, you know, going back to the Vietnam story, if he didn't do that, he thought about doing that. When he got back to the States, is that when he decided, you know, I'm going to start living out some of these fantasies that I've been having? Now, Shawcross is a suspect from the get-go, right? Because like I said, he'd been fishing with this boy. He knew this boy. But there was no evidence against him. The little boy's body would not be found until September. You know, so it was 4 months or so until they found his body. And they found it in a shallow grave just outside of town. You know, like we said, beaten, sexually abused, and strangled. But Jack Blake would be just the first of many, many victims of Arthur Shawcross. I mean, we're just getting started here. That's the sad part about it. Now, we said that they found Jack's body, but 4 days before they find it, they actually find another child, 8-year-old Karen Ann Hill, and they find her under a bridge near the Black River. She had been raped. She'd been suffocated, and grass had been stuffed in her nose and mouth.
So I wonder if he stuck grass up her nose and mouth, make her quiet?
Ahead of time.
Ahead of time?
Right. So prior to death or post-mortem.
Yeah.
I think prior, because why do it after?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it seems like you could find a better way to do it, but, you know, if you didn't have anything with you, I guess, and he didn't, maybe he was improvising. I don't know. We're making assumptions, but
yeah,
it's strange. Why do it?
I have someone in my life that's 8 years old.
Right. So you think about that.
I'm thinking about
her
right now and thinking about how could somebody do something like that?
Right. To an 8 year old.
Yeah. I don't understand it.
So we have to talk a little bit about what these two murders did to this little town of Watertown. It changed it completely, right? As you can imagine, it would. You know, this is 1972. This is back when kids were roaming around. I mean, I used to go out on my bike, travel all around the city with very little supervision.
Yeah, this just gives me flashbacks to when we did the Oakland County child killer. Remember, we were talking about the same thing. You didn't worry about playing outside and you know, make sure you're inside behind locked doors by dark, you know? And this is something back then that happened like 400 miles away. And where we live now, growing up, we remember hearing about it. And, you know, our parents were making us, you know, don't go far away from the house and be in before sundown. And
no, I think you're absolutely right, Gibbs, because, you know, it was said that kids were no longer safe to ride their bikes. They stopped going to the park. They didn't even want to go play baseball, right? They didn't want to get a game together to go play baseball. Everybody was scared for their lives.
That's pretty bad, man, when kids don't even want to play baseball.
It was really sad where it talked about how the parents, they had no idea how to explain to these kids how or why one of their peers had died so young. Right, it's not that they had an illness and died. They were brutalized by another human being. As a parent, how do you sit down and have that conversation with your child and say that, you know, there's a madman on the loose and he's committing these horrible acts against children? Don't go outside.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you go into that detail.
Yeah, I don't know.
But parents didn't know how to handle it. And that would be a very tough situation. It hit the whole town because this is not Detroit, right? Oakland County, that was a big area. This is a small town, Watertown.
Yeah.
Not that Oakland County didn't hit hard. It did. But does it hit even harder when you have this small, close-knit community?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would think it would.
Yeah.
And it hit the children especially hard. There were neighbors that would come out pretty quickly and say that they had seen Arthur Shawcross with Karen in the vicinity of the bridge before she disappeared. And the other thing was that Arthur had a history of little small run-ins with local children. I mean, he was known for some of these things. There was one incident where he had spanked a small boy and shoved grass down into his pants. Now, that had to pique somebody's interest.
Yeah, it's a little strange thing to do to a kid that doesn't belong to you.
Well, strange, you know, to spank somebody else's kid, but to shove grass down his pants when another girl was killed and grass was shoved in her nose and mouth. So apparently it was said that he just paid a little fine for that. But because of all these things, he was suspect number one from the get-go. And then the police received another report. And this was that Arthur was seen eating an ice cream at the very bridge where the body was found on the day it was found. Now, this is going to come up because this is part of Arthur's thing. And this is part of a lot of serial killers. What's the word I'm looking for? Gibbs?
M.O.?
Yeah, I don't know if it's M.O. because it's not the way they kill. It's their. It's something that they do where they revisit the scene. Or you hear about people attending somebody's funeral that they've killed.
So it's some way to relive it?
Maybe, but he'd like to go back to the scene of the crime. This is what he was doing. He was eating an ice cream cone.
Kind of like in celebration of what he did?
I don't know.
Like,
he was just sitting on the bridge in his car eating an ice cream cone. So the police pick him up for questioning because he's, you know, again, suspect number one. And they end up arresting him on October 3rd, 1972. So this is not very long, you know, less than a month, let's say, after Karen Ann Hill was found. Now, they had him for 2 weeks and he wasn't telling them much. But at the end of the 2 week period, Arthur ends up confessing to both murders.
Well, he was a lot different then. He was thin. He just out of the army. He was in good shape. He looked like he had very strong arms, very strong hands. And when he was agitated, really agitated, he was scary. You wouldn't want to be in the room with him alone. He looked a little strange, to be honest with you. And I did not get in the cell with him like I ordinarily would. I would always stay outside the cell so that we had the steel bars between us and talk to him there. And it appears that he made some sort of a confession. It wasn't an airtight confession. He said something to the effect, either I could have done it or I might have done it.
So the policeman was scared of Arthur, right? I mean, you hear him say it. I normally got in the cell with people, no problem. I was not willing to get in the cell with Arthur Shawcross. Now, Gibbs, I'm about ready to piss you off.
I bet. Here it comes.
Because he confesses to these two murders of these innocent kids. And he strikes a bargain, a plea bargain, which is in return for a guilty plea for murdering Karen Hill, he would not receive any charges in the death of Jack Blake. That was the deal.
Bunch of crock.
Well, it is. It's a crock of shit, but it's not even the worst part. Because then what happens is the case against him for the murder of Karen Hill gets reduced from murder to first-degree manslaughter.
Why in the world would they strike that type of deal?
Well, it has to do with some type of statute. And I don't know if it's still in effect. It was in effect back then. But this statute had something to do with acknowledging the fact that the killer had extreme emotional disturbances or issues. And so because of that, they had to reduce it from murder to first degree manslaughter. But that's a big difference. And we're going to find out what a big difference that is.
Yeah, so if they knew this was going to be the outcome, I don't understand why they took, you know, Jack off the table. It just doesn't make any sense to me, you know, because they could have eventually got him for both. And then if they had to plead down from that, it would have been stronger than what they ended up going to, I would think.
Yeah, and again, I don't know all the ins and outs of it. My assumption is that they didn't have the evidence. They had a confession.
Yeah.
But they didn't maybe have as much evidence against him for the Jack Blake murder as they did for the Karen Hill murder. So they thought that was a slam dunk. But did they not have the foresight to understand that this statute was going to come into effect and it was going to cause this sentence to be reduced? I can't answer that.
I can't even imagine what the parents or even the community felt at that point.
Well, I can tell you that the community was pissed, and that might be too light of a word for it. They thought this guy, you know, should have been put to death, right? You and I talk about this all the time. The killing of kids, there is nothing worse in people's minds or to get people fired up about. And there was talk that there was going to be a mob, a vigilante type mob, that was going to come and get Arthur Shawcross, and they were going to, as you say a lot of times, Gibbs, dole out their own kind of hometown justice.
Yeah. Send the posse.
So Arthur Shawcross never gets charged with the murder of Jack Blake, which is, like you said, very sad, and had to be troubling for Jack Blake's family. Even though they know he killed their son, I have to assume they feel like he was not held accountable for that. Because he wasn't. We're going to find out here in a minute. So Gibbs, Arthur Shaw Cross was never charged with the murder of Jack Blake, even though he admitted and confessed to raping the boy and murdering him. And he even showed police where he had dumped the body. And then later on,
yeah, this is sick.
Later on, as he's talking to these prison psychiatrists, he would tell them that, and this is what I was kind of foreshadowing about the fact that he liked to go back to the crime scene, that he had returned several times to where he had buried Jack's body and he had had sex with the corpse.
This is sick.
On multiple occasions. So ultimately, Shaw Cross gets sentenced to 25 years in prison. And this is what people were so upset about, Gibbs, because if he would have been held to the murder charge and convicted of that, then it would have been 25 to life.
Right.
And that's a much different sentence.
Huge.
Because you're serving 25 for sure.
Yep.
And then maybe you'll get paroled, but probably a much slimmer chance. So this is the second time that Arthur Shaw Cross has gone to jail. We talked about he had a 5-year sentence, got out early. Now he's got a 25-year sentence. It was said that for the first 8 years, he basically spent his whole time protecting himself from other inmates because he was a child killer.
Yeah, prison rules, man.
Yeah, and we know child killer is at the bottom of the list, bottom of the barrel. His record while he was in prison had so many fights. I guess he was lighting fires again somehow in the prison. He wouldn't leave his cell. You know, they had to force him out of his cell. But eventually, he started to settle into prison life. And that's what a lot of people do that, right? You become accustomed at some point. And it was said that he was a model prisoner after a certain period of time. And again, he saw psychiatrists the whole time he was in prison and was telling them the stories about Vietnam, but he wasn't telling them the truth. He wasn't coming across with all these delusions and things that would make them think he was a danger to society. So in 1973, he's tested by a prison psychologist. And there's a whole bunch of tests that he goes through, and they've got scientific names. But the results are that the tests don't show any evidence of neurological impairment. What they did find was that he suffered from depression and that he relied heavily upon fantasy as his source of satisfaction. But the final entry in Shaw Cross's prison file, psychological file, I should say, is that, and this is a quote, seems to be a normal individual who knows he has done wrong and would like to help himself get back on the right track for his eventual return to society. So in 1976, yet another psychologist examines Arthur, and this guy finds that he has not come to terms with his crimes and that he's constantly doing nothing but blaming other people for his problems. In this guy's opinion, he had snowballed the psychologist from 3 years earlier and had only requested that examination and told the guy what he thought he wanted to hear to impress the parole board. This guy kind of saw through him. And then 1 year later, they have another psychiatrist examine him. And this guy really nails it because he says that Shaw Cross has a schizoid personality. He's antisocial and that he has a very distinct personality disorder. He goes on to say, quote, "This man does not show a good degree of evidence of successfully resolving or working out his psychosexual conflicts. He hits it right on the head.
Yeah, it's a good statement.
Yeah, it's exactly what's going to turn out to happen. He's not resolved all these things. So Gibbs, what I believe is that he's having all these psychological evaluations, right? But it's all leading up to eventually he's going to go before the parole board. And so back to his that first one, he's trying to set it up so that when he does come before the parole board, he's got a body of work that's going to impress them. But what most of these doctors are saying is that Arthur Shawcross is by nature a pretty passive individual. But when he is subjected to any type of stress, he becomes a slave to his inner sexual drive, and he can't stop himself from giving in. So he has all these unfavorable psychological reports, except that very first one, which was seemed pretty good in his favor. But Arthur continues to improve himself in prison. So we're all the way up to 1985. There's a parole report that comes out, and it says that Shawcross exhibits a belligerent reaction representing a foreboding potential for a reenactment of his tragic behavior. So what's that saying? That if he gets out, he's going to do something bad again.
Yeah. Repeat.
And it goes on to criticize him because I guess he had this aversion to the sex offender program at the prison. And he also had an outburst during one of his parole interviews. So it doesn't sound like he's getting out anytime soon. But despite all of this stuff, they let him out in 1987 and deem Arthur Shawcross fit to reenter society.
Mistake.
Well, it's going to turn out to be a huge mistake. Right after his release, he goes to see his parole officer. And this guy writes a report. And the one sentence out of this report that is the most important says, "This writer," meaning the parole officer, "considers this man," being Arthur Shawcross, "to possibly be the most dangerous individual to be released to this community for many years." That's not a good sign.
No, that's not.
So Shawcross is released in the Binghamton area. And basically everybody in the town of Watertown had already made it clear that there is no way this guy's coming back there, right? Remember, they were pissed and they had not forgotten. There's no way they were going to let that guy come back and live in their town. So they put him in Binghamton. While he was in prison, he'd been having a pen pal relationship with this woman named Rose Wally. And he had told her that when he got out, he would come live with her and marry her. So we got to talk about his parole conditions. They require him to stay within one county, that's Broome County. He has an 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. curfew. So he's not allowed out during those hours. He's not allowed to drink any alcohol. And he's not allowed to have contact with anyone under the age of 18. And obviously has to stay away from school zones and any other. He can't go to Chuck E. Cheese or anything like that. But he's not in Binghamton long because the residents rise up and they basically say, "We don't want him here." They know what he's done. So they're forced to move him to Delhi, New York, and that's where he moves in with Rose Wally. It's not very long after he moves in there that the residents of Delhi, they figure out he's moved in, and they rise up and say, "We don't want this guy living here," and he gets forced out of there. So he moves to Fleischmann's, New York, and he and Rose move into this house. And Arthur actually gets a job with a local building contractor. Gibbs, within a matter of days, somebody recognizes him in the post office. And by that night, there's an angry mob coming down the street. And at the front of the mob is the town's mayor. He's awesome. Leading the mob.
Awesome.
They assemble outside of the house. And they basically say, "If you don't get the heck out of our town, something bad's going to happen." So they, and this keeps happening, they bounce around from one place to another until finally they end up in Rochester, New York, in an apartment.
Well, she's still sticking with him, isn't she? He must be worth it, even though these crazy mobs aren't happy, but I really like the guy.
Yeah, he's an ex-con. We can't live anywhere because nobody wants us because right. He killed kids.
Yeah.
They finally do settle in to this apartment in Rochester, and they're kind of stable for a while. And it's Christmas 1987, and Arthur asked his family. So we got to dissect this, Gibbs. But he asked his family to come to Rochester to meet Rose, and they refuse. I can't say I blame him a whole lot. But his sister tells him something that kind of starts a spiral. And what she tells him is that their mother has thrown away the present that Arthur sent her for Christmas. And that does something to him. He becomes very angry and he starts ranting about his family doesn't want anything to do with him. And it's just after this incident at Christmas that he actually starts a relationship with another woman named Clara Neal. And Clara Neal is going to be important in part two of the story. And for a year, he actually maintains both these relationships, one with Rose Wally and one with Clara Neal. And the only way he got by with it with Rose is that he said he was just being nice to Clara because he needed her car. All right, Gibbs. So like I said, this is going to start what I would call the second act or the second spiral of Arthur Shawcross.
Yeah, unfortunately, they let him out.
And it's going to get much, much worse. The number's going to get a lot higher, but everybody's going to have to wait for part two to find out the rest of the Arthur Shawcross story.
I don't have any remorse for some reason. It's not there. Like I said, I'm one side and the other side. I know something inside me is weird. And there's always a bad man in me. You never can get rid of it. He's behind a door somewhere. I'm trying to keep him there. I don't want to hurt nobody else.
All right, so that's it for this episode. Download next week, hear part two of this crazy Arthur Shawcross story. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.